with clubs shot again, their eyeballs will be pecked out by crows, their livers roasted. Dear, this is disgusting. And it goes on for quite a while. He skipped to the bottom. So turn around now, you blithering idiot. Sincerely, the Devil of Castel del Monte. Dr. Pym straightened up. Not very inviting, is it? Well, come along. And he climbed over the wall. Michael thought of asking whether it might not be wiser to call ahead, but Emma was already jumping down on the other side, and he hurried to follow. They had not gone 10 yards past the wall when there was a crack, and something zipped through the branches above their heads. Michael and Emma fell to their stomachs. "Do you know?" Dr. Pym had stopped walking, but was otherwise standing perfectly straight. "I think he just shot at us."
"Really?"
Emma said. She and Michael were flat on the ground.
"You think?"
Another crack, and a chunk of bark flew off a nearby tree. A voice shouted down something in Italian.
"Oh, honestly," Dr. Pym said. "This is ridiculous."
He called up the hill.
"Hugo, will you please stop shooting at us? It is extremely irritating."
There was a long moment of silence. Then the voice demanded, this time in English,
"Who is there?"
Keeping his head low, Michael peered up the slope. There was a small stone cottage just visible through the trees, but he couldn't see where the man was hidden.
"It's Stanislaus Pym, Hugo. I would like to speak with you."
There was a harsh laugh.
"Pym, you dunderhead! Couldn't you read the sign? Trespassers will be shot. Now about face and take your doddering carcass down the mountain before I do the world a favour and put a bullet through that oatmealy mishmash you call a brain." "Ah!" "Hugo,"
the wizard spoke as if to an unruly child,
"do you really think I've travelled this far just to go away? I'm coming up."
Michael thought he could hear the man muttering angrily.
"Hugo!"
There was a bellow of rage and then,
"So come up, why don't you? I always knew that respect for personal property was beyond your limited mental capacity."
And there was what sounded like someone furiously kicking a tree. Dr. Pym looked down at the children.
"It's safe now."
"Are you sure?"
Michael asked.
"Yeah," Emma said. "Maybe you should go first."
"It's fine. Trust me."
The children rose and brushed the dirt from their arms and legs. It was another 50 yards to the cottage, but the man didn't appear till they were 10 feet from the door, when he stepped from behind an overturned cart. His appearance was in every way striking. He had a short, wide body and a wide face. His clothes looked much worn and little washed. His hair and beard were wild and black, and neither had been trimmed for some time. Thick brows obscured his eyes, but the message in them was clear. This man was ready to fight the world. He held a rifle in his left hand.
"Stanislaus Pym," the man sneered. "Isn't it my lucky day? Surprised it only took you 10 years to find me. You must have had help." "You should not have disappeared, Hugo. It made things very difficult." "And you should try not being such a great pompous carbuncle. But the world is not a perfect place."
Then he turned and pushed through the door of the cottage. Dr. Pym and Emma followed, Emma immediately pinching her nose against the smell. Michael came last, pausing just inside the door. Beside him was an old wood chest, and on the chest was a framed black-and-white photograph. In it were two men in long black robes standing before a stone building. The taller of the men was also the younger by a dozen years, and he held what looked like a rolled-up diploma. He wore wire-rimmed glasses, and his hand rested on the shoulder of the second man, a short, heavy-set man with wild black hair. The black-haired man was the devil of Castel del Monte. Just then, the real devil of Castel del Monte appeared and slapped down the photograph.
"No snooping," he growled.
Michael stood there another few seconds, waiting for his heart to stop pounding in his chest. He had no idea why the wizard had brought them there, or who the black-haired man was. But one thing he did know. The tall young man in the photo was his father. Chapter 4. Dr. Hugo Algernon.
"Shut the door, my boy, if you would."
Michael wondered if that was such a good idea. The man's cottage smelled like a barn, and in fact an entire half of it was covered in piles of dirty straw and appeared to have been ceded to the goats. Three of the animals idled near the back wall, eating their dinners and watching the visitors with dull expressions. The left side of the cottage seemed designated to the man's use. Besides the chest, there was a lumpy-looking mattress, an old wooden table and two chairs, a battered gas lantern, a fireplace in which a few glowing logs lay smoking, a collection of unwashed pots, pans, cups, plates, bowls, and hundreds of books. Many of the books showed signs of having been chewed on or partially eaten, perhaps by mice or the man's four-legged roommates, or, Michael could almost imagine, the man himself, in various fits of rage. As Michael closed the door, the man was wrestling with a goat that was munching its way through a sheaf of papers.
"Let go, you scoundrel! I'm warning you, Stanislaus!"
It took Michael a moment to realize that the man was speaking to the goat.
"Hugo," the wizard said, smiling, "did you name this little fellow after me? I'm touched."
"Don't be," the man grunted, still engaged in a tug-of-war over the pages.
"He's the stupidest goat in Italy. I wanted his name to adequately reflect the depth of his ignorance. Yours was the obvious choice. Ah!"
The goat had jerked backward, and the man lost his grip and thudded onto his rear. With a bleat of triumph, the goat clattered out the open back door and across the hill, whipping the pages this way and that.
10 years I've been working on that book," the man shouted, jumping up and shaking his fist at the departing goat. "Any time I make the least progress, one of those idiots goes and eats it, though they're probably better judges of the material than the so-called experts."
He glanced at Dr. Pym.
"Present company included, of course."
"So is that what you've been up to all this time?"
the wizard asked.
"Writing a book? What is it about, if I may ask?"
"It's called A History of Stupidity in the Magical World. And needless to say, you figure prominently. I even thought of including your photo, but I didn't want to scare off potential readers. Ah!"
"I certainly have made my share of mistakes," the wizard replied.
"Listen to him, Mr. I'm So Reasonable. If I were you, Pym, I doubt I'd ever stop punching myself in the face."
A small kettle hung on an arm above the fire, and the man poured himself a cup of the hottest, blackest coffee Michael had ever seen. It bubbled from the kettle's mouth like boiling mud. The man said he would offer them some, but he was afraid that would give the impression he wanted them to stay. Then, without warning, he whirled about and fixed his fierce gaze on Michael.
"Do I know you?"
"No," Michael said awkwardly. "We've never met." "Hugo, these are my friends Michael and Emma. Children, this is Dr. Hugo Algernon."
"Yes, yes, yes,"
the man said, crashing onto a chair.
"Let's just get this over with. What is it you want? Recruiting me for another of your boneheaded schemes? You may as well forget it. You hoodwinked me once, but never again."
The wizard had pulled up the second chair, while the children had found seats on an upside-down washbasin, which, by all appearances, had never been used.
"I am here," Dr. Pym said, "for two reasons, but I must say how exasperating it has been to have to track you down."
"No one asked you to,"
the wizard sighed.
"I am here to give you a warning and to ask a question."
"A warning? From you? Ha! Let's have it."
"Jean-Paul Latreau and Kenji Kitano are both dead."
Michael could see that the news had an effect on the man, even though he tried to act as if it didn't.
"Murdered?"
"Yes."
"When?"
"Jean-Paul, I found out about on Christmas Day. Kenji was a few weeks after."
Michael looked at his sister and saw the same expression on her face that he imagined was on his.
"Dr. Pym?"
"Yes, my boy, that was what called me away on Christmas. Jean-Paul and Kenji were both friends and fellow magicians. I would have told you earlier, but the Signora's Café did not seem the appropriate place to go into detail."
"Who was it?"
Michael asked.
"I mean, who killed them? Was it—"
"Who killed them?"
the hairy man roared.
"Who do you think killed them? The Dire Magnus, the Undying One, the—"
"Yes,"
Dr. Pym said, cutting him off.
"Or, more specifically, his followers."
Hugo Algernon leaped up and began stalking back and forth, smashing his fists together and snarling.
"This wasn't supposed to happen, Stanislaus. Do you remember?"
"I do. I remember. I remember when you brought us all together."
And he imitated poorly the wizard's voice.
"We must act now. We must end his power once and for all."
He let out a harsh laugh.
"That worked out well, wouldn't you say? Ha!"
"It did work," the wizard said calmly. "His power was greatly diminished."
"Oh, diminished. Yes, diminished. Tell that to Jean-Paul and Kenji. I'm sure they'll agree with you. Diminished. Ha!"
Dr. Pym sighed.
"I did not come to argue, but merely to tell you to take precautions. He is tracking down all who once stood against him."
"What's he talking about?"
Emma said.
"What are you talking about?"
"My dear,
Emma's right."
Michael tried to sit up and look as old a sibling-esque as possible.
"I'm sorry, but you're always saying how now's not the time to explain stuff, and then you take us someplace and we have no idea why we're there, and crazy people shoot at us. No offence, Dr. Algernon, but it's not fair. Who's the Dire Magnus? What's he want? What are you two talking about? We deserve to know what's going on."
This was one of the longest speeches Michael had ever made, and when he finished, he was out of breath. Emma was staring at him wide-eyed with amazement.
"Ha!"
Hugo Algernon smacked the table.
"The boy's got a spirit. Go on and tell them, Pym. Tell them everything you've managed to learn about the Dire Magnus in thousands of years. It shouldn't take more than 10 seconds.
The old wizard frowned, but finally nodded.
"Hugo is trying to be cantankerous, but he makes a fair point. My knowledge of the Dire Magnus is sadly incomplete. I believe him to be a man, and a powerful sorcerer, certainly. Beyond that, he is a mystery. His origins, his true name, I cannot tell you. What I can say is that I have been upon this earth since the first cities rose in the desert, and there has always been a Dire Magnus. His power waxes and wanes, he rises and is beaten back, and since the books were created, it has been his one goal to possess them."
"Not bad,"
the man said.
20 seconds. You knew more than I thought."
The wizard continued.
"I have, over time, made attempts to confront him. The last was 40-odd years ago. I gathered together a group of magicians, wizards, witches, mages,
Dr. Algernon here among them. We hunted him down. We fought him. Many of our friends fell, but we prevailed. He was destroyed.
Hugo Algernon let out another dismissive, ha! And threw his empty mug over his shoulder, starting a small stampede of goats out of the door.
Or so we believed. Dr. Pym rubbed at his eyes. What we found was that death was not a prison for such as he. Even trapped in the land of the dead, his spirit continued to wield influence and power over his followers.
And now, said Hugo Algernon, he's settling scores.
He is doing more than that, my friend. He is building an army.
The wizard looked at the children.
You asked about Gabriel. While I have been tracking down and warning those who once helped me fight the Dire Magnus, he has been monitoring the enemy's movements. Since you last saw him, he has been in almost constant danger.
Dr. Pym turned back to the man.
The enemy's strength is growing, Hugo. You can hide on this mountain and say the world is filled with fools, but a war is coming, and it will find even you.
For a moment, the fierce, bearded man seemed checked. Then his mouth curled into a sneer.
Warning received and already forgotten. Now, what's your question? Be quick. I've got to find your namesake before he eats the rest of my book. I've come up with a new chapter while you've been talking. It's called Paranoid Old Fools. Ah!
Very well, the wizard said. I would like to know about the last time you saw Richard and Claire Wibberley.
Outside, the shadows had begun to lengthen, and Dr. Algernon turned on the lantern. Before setting it on the table, he held it to Emma's and Michael's faces. He stared at Michael for several long moments.
I knew it. You're the spitting image of your father.
Really?
Michael could feel himself grinning. I mean, really?
I said so, didn't I? Are you deaf?
No.
You look just like him. Don't make me say it again.
He looked at Emma.
The two of you twins?
No,
Michael said somewhat hotly. I'm a year older.
Well, technically, Emma said, we're both 12, technically.
Michael was about to argue when the man spoke.
Where's the third one, Pym? There's supposed to be a third. Sadly, she was unable to join us tonight, but we expect to see her again soon.
Yeah, Emma said, very, very soon.
The man grunted and placed the lantern on the table.
I don't know what Pym's told you, not much, I wager, but most of us who trafficked as magicians ended up straddling two worlds, the magical and the mundane. We had actual jobs. Some idiots had families. Besides my other, call them extracurricular activities, I taught folklore and mythology at Yale.
Your father was a grad student, and unlike most of the students, he was not a total idiot.
I could tell right away he knew that magic was real. You get that in folklore departments. People have figured out the truth, but they can't come to college and study magic. So they study folklore and myth, sensing that those stories reflect how the world used to be. That was your dad. I was foolish back then, almost as foolish as Dr. Puddingbrain here. I thought that magic had a chance, that people like your dad could help, so I brought him along, taught him everything I could. I remember he had an unusual affection for dwarves.
Dwarves?
Michael nearly jumped to his feet.
Really? I have a certain, call it, interest in dwarves. He means he's in love with them,
Emma said.
Was he fond of anything in particular?
Michael asked eagerly.
Granted, there's so much to choose from. Where do you even start?
Hugo Algernon scratched at his beard.
Well,
He was always quoting this one line from old Killinkillick, something about a great leader.
"Lives not in his heart, but in his head," Michael finished. "I know that quote. I was just talking about it today." "Unbelievable!"
He clapped his hands together, smiling from ear to ear. Not only did he and his father both admire and esteem dwarves, they'd also each separately singled out the same quote. If that wasn't a sign of, well, something, then Michael didn't know what was.
"Do you remember how he felt about elves?
I imagine he thought they were pretty ridiculous."
Dr. Pym coughed.
"Perhaps we could stay on subject. Hugo, if you could continue?" "Fine, fine. So, in his second year, I told Richard about the Books of Beginning."
Hugo Algernon looked at Dr. Pym.
"How much do they know about the books?"
"I'm sure they would be interested in anything you have to say."
"Here's what you need to remember. The Books of Beginning are three incredibly old and powerful books of magic. If you believe the stories, they could literally remake the world. Most reports start with the books in the Egyptian city of Rakotis, guarded by a gaggle of what had to have been the most mossy-brained magicians of all time. Granted, that's just my opinion, though I'm no doubt correct. Everything's fine till one day. This is about 2,500 years ago. Alexander the Great shows up, burns the city to the ground, and the books vanish. So, your dad hears all this and gets a bee in his bonnet. Why have the books never been located? How amazing would it be if he found the books? On and on, I told him to forget it. People had been looking for the books for thousands of years, real magicians and wizards, and no one had ever found diddly squat. Anyway, Richard took his degree, left, got married, decided the world wasn't crowded enough, and had you sardines. I mean, children. Next thing I know, Pim's here taking him up. Read some article your dad wrote. Thought he'd make this big discovery.
Again, mimicking the wizard, he spoke into a pretend telephone.
Oh, cheerio, Hugo. I've found the most promising young man. Tut-tut, I'm such a great galumphing booby. He was my student first. You just finish the story, Hugo.
The man scowled, but went on.
So, time passes, and one day, I'm in Buenos Aires. There was this old wizard who'd lived down there. Mad as a hatter, but an excellent archivist and a collector of rare manuscripts. He died, and I was going through his library. House was a wreck, held together by dust and mouse droppings. Anyway, I'm there working when the library floor gives way. Almost broke my neck. But when I could finally look around, I saw I'd fallen into a kind of vault. Stacks of old books and documents. I spent a year going through and cataloguing everything, and then I find a letter. It was in an extinct Portuguese dialect. Thing was murder to translate, but I had a feeling about it. A man writing to his wife. Apparently, he was on some kind of 18th-century business trip, buying pigs or llamas or something, and he writes how he'd gotten into town late, and all the inns had been full, and he'd had to share a room with a sick man. His roommate was feverish. All night he raved how he and a few others had taken a magic book out of Egypt long ago and had hidden it away. He kept saying, "I must make the map. I must draw the map."
"And then what happened?"
the wizard asked.
Hugo Algernon shrugged. "Nothing. The rest of the letter was about a pig he'd bought and how plump it was and blah, blah, blah."
"And where did this encounter take place?"
"In Malpessa."
Ah, was Malpessa? Michael asked.
Malpessa, the wizard replied, is a city at the southern tip of South America, on the coast of Tierra del Fuego, the land of fire. It was first an Indian village, then became a colonial trading post, a stopover for ships going from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Then, when the magic world pulled away, Malpessa went with it.
The old man turned back to Hugo Algernon.
So when you read this letter and realized what it meant, why did you contact Richard and not me?
Because, you great ninny, you're impossible to get a hold of. I thought Richard could find you, and...
He glanced at Michael and Emma, and some of the energy and fury seemed to go out of him.
I knew about the children. Richard had told me who they were, that they were the children of the prophecy, the three who would finally bring the books together and fulfill their destiny.
Michael felt his spine tighten. In Cambridge Falls, the Countess had mentioned the prophecy to Kate. Only the witch hadn't said what the book's destiny actually was, or what it meant for the three of them. Hugo Algernon went on,
When I got back to the States, I called him. A week or so later, Richard showed up at my house in New Haven. Claire was with him. Must have been close to midnight. I knew something was wrong, but he insisted I tell him what I'd discovered, and I did.
When was this?
Christmas, 10 years ago. The day after his family had supposedly disappeared.
Hugo Algernon looked at Michael and Emma.
I imagine I was the last person to see your parents.
The door behind the children had blown open, but no one moved to close it. Michael felt a cool wind against his neck. Emma was clenching his hand. Michael reflected that he and Emma knew more about their parents' fate than ever before, but there were still so many questions. Had their parents reached this city, Malpessa? Had they found the map? Who had this sick man and his comrades been? And then there was the mystery of the book itself. Dr. Pym had taken the Atlas out of Egypt. Michael remembered his story of keeping it safe for 1,000 years before entrusting it to the dwarves. So, of the two remaining books, which one was this? What were its powers? For the 1,000th time, Michael wished that Kate were with them. The wizard rose and shut the door, then returned to the table. He said,
There's more, isn't there?
Hugo Algernon rubbed his dirty fingers through his beard and nodded.
I didn't find out that Richard and Claire's family had gone missing till a few days later. I tried to get in touch with you, obviously. That was pointless.
Tell us about it, Emma muttered.
I talked to some of the others, John Paul, for one. I didn't tell them anything, just that I needed to talk to you about Richard and Claire. Maybe someone was listening. Maybe there was a traitor. I don't know.
As the man spoke, he dug his fingernails into the wood of the table.
Must have been a week later. I get a knock at the door. I open it, not thinking anything. And there he is. Smiling.
Hugo Algernon raised his head and looked at the children.
You two ever see a man coming, huge, bald, not a hair on him? Run. Run and don't ever stop running.
It was Rourke,
the wizard said.
Yeah, it was Rourke.
The man went back to digging his nails into the table.
What happened then?
What happened then? You want to know how much I fought before I betrayed my friends? Oh, I fought all right, but he was too strong, and I could feel him in my head. He was laughing the whole time. I heard myself telling him that Richard and Claire had gone to Malpessa. I woke up the next morning and realized that not only had I betrayed my friends, but Rourke had broken something in me. I'd never been a great magician, we both know that, but whatever I'd had was gone. I walked out of my house, never called anyone, just disappeared.
and Michael suddenly understood why this man had spent 10 years in a lonely cottage on a mountain in Italy. He wasn't hiding from the dire Magnus. He was hiding from what he'd done, from himself. Michael felt a strange, powerful sympathy for him.
"Then why hasn't Rourke found the book?" Dr. Pym asked. "He must have the information you gave Richard and Claire."
Hugo Algernon shook his head.
"I gave them a charm that would wipe all knowledge of the book from their memories. They must have used it before they were caught. I should have taken better precautions with myself. As it was, all Rourke got from me was the name Malpessa."
"You didn't tell him about the sick man or the map?"
"No, I betrayed my friends, but the secret of the book I buried deep. Even he couldn't find it."
"You shouldn't have told him anything,"
Emma cried, pounding the table with her small fist.
"You should have said nothing."
The man nodded and said,
"You're right, child. That's what I've been thinking about for the past 10 years.
Dr. Algernon got up and walked to the fireplace. He pulled out a loose stone, then reached in and removed a folded moleskin packet.
"These are my original notes. I keep them hidden so the goats don't eat them. I always knew you'd find me sooner or later."
He handed the packet to the wizard.
"There may be a war coming, Stanislaus, but I'm no good to you. The magic's left me."
Then he turned to face Michael and Emma.
"If you find your father, tell him I'm sorry. Tell him that Hugo Algernon's just an old fool."
Dr. Pym stepped to the door and fit his ornate gold key into the lock. He turned it 4 times to the right, 7 to the left. There was a click, and he pushed the door open. Sunlight flooded the cottage. Michael and Emma found themselves looking out over a vast expanse of blue water, with the sun poised in the distance. But only the doorway was illuminated. The cottage's windows remained dark.
"This way, children."
Michael took one last look at the devil of Castel del Monte. He sat at the table, petting a small goat that had come up to nuzzle his leg.
"Dr. Algernon!"
The wild-haired man lifted his head, and sunlight intended for some other place in the world revealed his eyes for the first time. They were dark brown and very sad. Michael said,
"We're going to find them!"
And he was about to step across the threshold when the man said quietly,
"Hold a second."
Hugo Algernon went to the frame photo Michael had seen earlier and removed the backing.
"Here."
He pushed the photo into Michael's hands. Michael looked down at his father, young, smiling, filled with hope. He pulled out his dwarf omnibus and slipped the photo between the pages.
"Thank you."
The man nodded and turned away. Michael stepped through the door. They were on top of a cliff. Dr. Algernon's door, now closed behind them, had become the door of a whitewashed house with red shutters. Flowers spilled from window boxes, filling the salty air with a sweet aroma. Michael looked out over the water to where the sun hung upon the horizon. Was it sunrise or sunset?
"Dr. Pym, we are in Galicia, in northwest Spain."
The wizard slid the golden key into the pocket of his jacket.
"This house belongs to a friend of mine. He's away, but we'll spend the night here, and tomorrow head to Malpessa."
"Will Kate be there?"
Emma asked. Michael could tell she was trying not to sound too hopeful, but hoping desperately all the same.
"We'll see, my dear."
And Dr. Pym placed a gentle hand on her shoulder and led her into the house. The children sat at the kitchen table while Dr. Pym prepared glasses of warm milk and distracted them with stories of the strange things he had seen in his travels, stories that at any other time Michael would have been furiously copying into his journal. At one point, Dr. Pym switched on the light above the table, and Michael glanced out the window and saw that night had fallen, and the exhaustion of a day that had begun in Baltimore with him and Kate running before a storm settled upon him. He felt as if his head were made of stone. His arms and legs weighed thousands of pounds. However, once they'd drunk their milk and the glasses stood drying in the rack, and Emma had hugged Dr. Pym and headed up to bed, Michael found himself lingering in the kitchen.
"Yes, my boy?"
Dr. Pym was packing his pipe.
"What's troubling you?"
"Who was that man who hurt Dr. Algernon? Does he work for the Diamagnus?"
"His name is Declan Rourke.
And yes, he is one of the Diamagnus's lieutenants, indeed his chief lieutenant, and a very dangerous and, in my opinion, unbalanced individual."
"And you think he's the one who took our parents?"
Dr. Pym had his pipe going, and the sweet, almondy smell filled the kitchen.
"I'm afraid so. I think they followed Dr. Algernon's clues, and somewhere in their search, Rourke caught them."
He shook his head sadly.
"Richard and Claire believed that finding the books was the only way to keep you and your sisters safe, and everything else, including their own lives, was secondary."
Michael nodded. He still made no move to go upstairs. He found he had been winding the strap of his bag around his finger and had somehow gotten it into a knot so that the tip of his finger was turning blue. He yanked it free, and the colour slowly returned.
"Anything else, my boy?"
"What did that letter say, the one Kate sent you, that made you come to Baltimore?"
"She'd been having a dream. She saw an orphanage attacked by the Diamagnus's forces. She'd recognized it as somewhere the three of you had lived. She knew it was only a matter of time before he found you. Why do you ask?"
She made me promise to take care of Emma. It was like she knew she wasn't going to be here. I just wondered if she'd said something."
"As a matter of fact, she did."
"What?"
"Several months ago, she wrote to me about another dream she'd had. In it, you were holding a book she didn't recognize. Emma was with you, and the two of you were surrounded by fire."
"And Kate wasn't there?"
The wizard shook his head. Michael still made no move to leave. He began fidgeting again with his strap.
"I know the real question you want to ask."
Michael looked up.
"You want to ask about the prophecy Dr. Algernon mentioned, how it was foretold that three children will bring the books together and fulfill their destiny. The truth is, I do not know what that destiny is."
"You could guess, though, couldn't you?"
"Perhaps, but I will not. This is what you must understand. The magic in the books is without equal. It is the power to alter the very nature of existence, to reshape the world. Imagine that power in the hands of a being whose heart is filled only with hate and anger. With such power, the Diamagnus would have dominion over every living creature. That is why our quest is so important, and why so much depends on you."
Michael said nothing. He felt as if his chest was being squeezed by iron bands.
"But Catherine believed in you, and so do I. Now, I foresee a demanding day ahead of us, and you need your sleep."
By the time Michael got upstairs, Emma was already in her bed, and the light was off. Michael maneuvered by moonlight, doing his best to be quiet. Emma spoke to him from the darkness.
"Michael?"
"Yes?"
"Do you really think Kate's waiting for us in the future?"
Michael took a deep breath and wondered what Kate would want him to say.
"Yes,"
he lied.
"I do. Me too."
Michael kicked off his shoes and got into bed. He set his bag on the floor. The window was open, and he could hear the far-off sound of the sea hitting the rocks.
"Michael?"
"Yes?"
"Don't leave me, okay?"
"I won't."
Soon afterward, Michael knew that his sister was asleep. But exhausted as he was, he lay there long into the night, watching the moon move across the water, thinking about their parents and how they had disappeared, thinking about Kate, lost somewhere in time, thinking again and again how it was now all up to him. "Kate," he thought, "where are you?" Chapter 5 Rafe.
"Nah, look, she moved. She ain't dead. Poke her again."
Kate felt something jab her in the ribs. She stirred and tried to push it away.
"See? Told you she ain't dead. Too bad we'd have gotten $5 for her if she was dead."
"How $5?
"Rafe says you can sell dead bodies to the Doctor College. They give you $5 each one."
"What they want dead bodies for?"
"So's they can cut them open and look at their guts and all."
"$5, huh?"
"Yeah. Poker again."
The voices belonged to children, boys. Kate thought it best to speak up before they got any ideas.
"I'm not dead."
She forced her eyes open and pushed herself into a sitting position. Her head, indeed her whole body, was throbbing. She felt as if she'd run a marathon, gotten in a fight, and then been systematically pounded on for several hours. Even her teeth ached. She took in her surroundings. She was lying on a wooden floor, and the room about her was cold and small, and the only light was what filtered through a pair of filthy windows. Two boys were leaning over her. She guessed they were about 10. Their faces and hands were streaked with dirt. Their clothes had been patched, torn, and then patched again. They both wore cloth caps. One of them held a stick.
"I'm not dead," Kate repeated.
"Nah," said the one, not bothering to hide his disappointment. "I guess you ain't."
"Where am I?"
"You're on the floor."
"No, I mean, where is this?"
"What are you talking about? You're in the Bowery."
The whites of the boy's eyes stood out against the dirtiness of his face.
"The Bowery?"
The name was vaguely familiar, but she couldn't place it.
"Where is that?"
"She means what city?" said the boy with the stick.
"Come off it," the other said, finally smiling, forgetting the $5 he'd have gotten for Kate's corpse.
"You don't know what city. You're in New York."
"New York? But how?"
And then she remembered. She remembered being with Michael and Emma in Miss Crumley's office, and the storm outside, and the screecher breaking through the tower window and seizing her arm, and she remembered how she had called upon the Atlas for the first time in months, and her terror as the magic had swept through her. She remembered opening her eyes and finding herself on a beach under a blazing sun as three wooden ships with tall white sails approached across a sea of brilliant, shimmering blue. She remembered the pain in her arm telling her that the screecher had not let go, and Kate remembered how, without thinking, she had called upon the magic a second time, and a second time it had flowed through her, and a moment later she and the creature were struggling atop a stone wall. It had been night. There'd been fire and smoke and shouting, a city in flames, and still the creature had gripped her arm. And Kate remembered how frantic she'd been, knowing that her plan wasn't working, knowing that she was getting weaker. And she'd called on the magic a third time, thinking, "Please help me." And suddenly she'd been standing in a muddy field under a sky of grey. There had been more screaming, and another sound like insects whizzing past her face, and still the creature held on. And Kate remembered the explosion and the feeling of being lifted into the air. And then she remembered nothing. And then she remembered waking up in the mud, and men with guns running past, their mouths open and screaming, though all she could hear was the ringing in her ears. And she remembered seeing the screecher sprawled 10 yards away, and the Atlas between them, and how the creature had begun crawling toward the book, and she remembered knowing that her life depended on getting there first, and knowing also that the creature was closer. And she remembered the second explosion, the one that had knocked the monster away, and how, with one final effort, she had reached out and laid her hand upon the book. Kate lurched to her feet.
Where is it?
Where's what?
My book. I had a book. A green book.
The floor was covered with piles of dusty rags, dented cans, yellowed scraps of newspaper, rotted out burlap sacks. Kate tore through it all, tossing things left and right, so that the two boys were forced back against the door.
"What have you done with it? Where is it?"
"We didn't take no book," said the boy with a stick.
"Yeah, what do we want a book for?"
said the other, as if having or wanting a book was the silliest idea in the world. An awful thought occurred to Kate.
"How long have I been here?"
"Dunno."
"When did you find me? It's important."
"Couple hours ago you were just lying here. I went to get Jake."
He nodded at the boy with a stick.
"Figured if you were dead we could get the wheelbarrow, take you down to the doctor college. We could have used $5.
Kate couldn't breathe. She pushed past the two boys and through the wooden door. Pale sunlight blinded her, and she threw up an arm. She looked about, blinking. She was on a rooftop. A maze of low buildings stretched out in all directions. The room she'd woken in was a kind of shed. The air was bitingly cold. She could see her breath before her. Ice and old snow crunched beneath her feet. Dressed for summer, Kate could only hug her arms tight to her body. She stepped to the edge of the roof and looked down. The building was just 6 stories high, and she could make out huge snowdrifts funneling people along sidewalks. In the street, horses were pulling carts, undisturbed by the presence of cars and buses. Kate listened for engines, horns, the squeal of tires, but the only sounds were of people and carts and horseshoes. She scanned the horizon. There was not a tall building in sight. Her heart began to beat faster, and a memory came to her. Michael had been trapped in the past, held prisoner by the Countess, and she and Emma had gone back to rescue him. They'd been in the past scarcely half an hour when the Atlas had faded and vanished before their eyes. Kate remembered the witch explaining how the Atlas, belonging to that time, had exerted its dominance, that 2 copies of the book could coexist for a brief period, but eventually one would vanish. The boy said that he'd found her 2 hours ago. The book was long gone. A hand grabbed her arm and she whirled about, thinking the screecher had somehow followed her. It was one of the boys.
"You gotta be careful. You're gonna fall."
Kate stepped back from the edge.
"What's the date?"
"December something."
"I mean, what year is it?"
"You kidding?"
"Just tell me."
"It's 1899,
the other said.
"How don't you know that?"
Kate said nothing. She just looked out at the white rooftops of the city. She was cold and alone, and she was trapped in the year 1899. How was she ever going to get home? The boys, their names were Jake and Beatles, no explanation, said that seeing as things hadn't turned out as they'd hoped, and she appeared to be more or less alive, she had to come and see Rafe. Kate told them that she didn't know who Rafe was, and she had no intention of going to see him. The only thing that mattered, she thought this, but didn't say it, was finding a way back to her brother and sister.
"Where are the stairs?"
"You can't just go up," Beetle said. "Anyway, you'll freeze."
The boy had a point. While he and his partner each had on 2 jackets, multiple shirts, and heavy-looking wool trousers, every article patched and raggedy, but no less warm for that. Kate wore just an old pair of sandals and a sleeveless summer dress. She was already shaking. She was also, she noticed, covered in dried mud.
"Fine. Where?"
Her teeth had begun to chatter. "Where can I get a coat?"
"Over on Bowery."
"I thought I was in the Bowery."
"I mean the street. Come on."
The boys led her to the fire escape. A rickety, rusting skeleton flimsily attached to the side of the building, which they raced down pell-mell, setting up a great rattling and shaking. Kate hurried after them, certain that at any moment the whole contraption was going to break free of its moorings and plunge into the alley. A ladder at the bottom stopped 9 feet off the ground, and the boys dangled from the last rung and dropped, landing cat-like on their hands and feet. Kate did her best to follow suit, but found herself hanging in mid-air, unwilling to let go.
"Come on!" the boys yelled. "It ain't far! Come on!"
She grunted in pain as her feet struck the frozen stones, and a shudder passed through her ankles. She stood, the heels of her hands stinging.
"Finally," Jake said. "I thought you were going to set up house there or something. Maybe open a shop, huh?"
said Beatles.
"Yeah, the hanging at the end of the ladder too scared to let go shop."
"You're hilarious," Kate said. "Just show me where to get a coat." They led her down the alley and across the street that Kate had seen from the roof of the building. Her sandaled feet sank deep into the drifts, and hard crusts of snow scratched her bare legs. She tried not to notice the stares she got, a girl in a thin dress in the middle of winter, and she followed her two guides down another alley and out into a street that was wider than the first and lined end to end with stalls. Throngs of darkly clad men and women milled between the ramshackle booths as vendors stood about, extolling the qualities of their goods in one language or another.
"This is Bowery," said Beatles. "You can get a coat here." I don't have any money."
Now that they'd stopped moving, Kate was trembling badly.
"You got anything you can trade?" Jake asked. "What about that locket?"
Kate's hand went to her throat, her numb fingers fumbling at the gold locket. Her mother had given her the locket the night their family had been separated.
I can't." "What else you got?"
But Kate had nothing else. Her mother's locket was the only valuable thing she owned, and she was freezing, literally freezing to death. She could ask for help from the people walking past, but that would require explanations. Who she was, how she had come to be here.
"The chain's gold. I can trade the chain, but I'm keeping the locket."
The boys took her to a mute old man, who examined the chain, nodded, and gave Kate a shabby, moth-eaten coat and a wool hat. She pulled them both on, grateful, and her shaking began to subside.
"All right," Jake said. "We helped you. Now you gotta come see Rafe."
Again, Kate refused.
"Rafe ain't gonna like it," Beatles said.
"I really don't care what Rafe likes." And she turned away down the line of stalls. She was still shivering slightly, the cold being very cold and her new coat and hat very thin and ragged. But she had held on to her mother's locket and she was not going to freeze to death. That was all that mattered. So what if she couldn't feel her toes? "Your problem now," she told herself, "is getting home." Her copy of the Atlas had disappeared because another copy already existed in this time. Kate knew where that copy was, far to the north, in the mountains surrounding Cambridge Falls. It was locked in a vault beneath the old dwarf city, and her first thought, back on the roof when she'd realized her situation, had been to make her way north and retrieve the book. But she'd quickly abandoned that plan. The copy in the vault had to be there for her and Michael to discover in the future. It felt strange to be protecting events that were still 100 years off, events that in her mind had already taken place, but such were the ironies of time travel. And, truth be told, Kate was relieved that she wouldn't be swimming through the long underground tunnel that led to the vault. The last time she'd done it, she'd watched a dwarf get pulled down by the creature that lived in the depths, and she was not at all eager to go back. Her second idea was, on the surface, much simpler. Find Dr. Pym and have him send her home. The Countess had helped Kate travel through time without the Atlas. The witch had tapped into the magic inside her, the power of the Atlas that was, even now, coursing through her veins. Kate was certain that Dr. Pym could do the same. But how to go about finding him? Could the dwarves help? Michael had said that a dwarf might live for hundreds of years. Was it possible that Robbie McClower was alive? Surely he would be able to contact the wizard. Once again it seemed that Kate's only hope lay in going to Cambridge Falls, but it was a daunting journey. She would need to take the train to Westport, provided the trains in this time ran to Westport, find passage across Lake Champlain. Then there was the long road into the mountains, and she would need money to buy tickets and food and, as soon as possible, shoes and socks and a sweater, and she willed herself not to panic. One step at a time, she could do this. She sensed the boys coming up behind her and glanced over to see them each juggling a blackened, smoking potato. They passed their prizes from hand to hand, blowing on them until they were cool enough to crack open, an act the pair performed with relish, inhaling as the released steam rose into their faces.
"You want some?"
asked the boy named Jake. Before she could answer, he'd ripped his in half and handed it over. The skin of the potato was black and flaky, but the inside was soft and smeared with a greasy, buttery fat. And as she ate it, Kate felt herself warmed, and she was grateful to the boy for sharing. She felt no ill will toward them for hoping to sell her corpse. They were clearly very poor, and in 1899, $5 was no doubt a fortune. As the trio threaded their way through the crowded market, Kate found herself wondering who the boys were. Did they have families? Unlikely. Their clothes were too hodgepodge, their faces too dirty. Perhaps they lived in an orphanage, also unlikely. Kate knew what orphanage children looked like. Even the rebellious ones had an anxiousness that these boys lacked. So, where did they live? Who protected them? They reached an intersection. A bone-thin, dark-haired man stood in the midst of a small crowd, talking loudly in a language Kate didn't understand. He had a long black beard, no shirt, and in his left hand he held a flaming torch. With a cry, the man ran the torch over his pale, sunken chest, down his other arm, over his head, and suddenly the whole upper half of his body, including his long beard, was engulfed in flame. Kate was about to scream, to call for water, when the small group of spectators began clapping their mittened hands, and she saw that the man's skin was neither burning nor blackening. Indeed, he appeared to be grinning. What was going on? Then she heard,
"Dragon eggs! Real dragon eggs! Raise your own dragon!"
Coming toward her was a red-faced, frazzle-haired woman whose hands and forearms were marked with burn scars. The woman carried a basket lined with old hay in which were nestled three enormous eggs. The eggs were dark green and leathery, each one the size of a grapefruit, and they were all smoking ominously.
"Dragon eggs!"
the woman called, continuing down the street.
"3 weeks from hatching makes a wonderful companion."
Kate turned to the boys who were licking butter off their fingers and seemed totally unfazed.
"Did you see that?"
"See what?" asked Jake.
"What do you mean, what? That man's on fire. People are clapping, and that woman's selling those eggs."
The boy shrugged.
"That's Yakov. He's always setting himself on fire."
"And I bet those ain't real dragon eggs,"
Beetle said.
"You'd probably end up with a chicken or something."
Kate was so stunned by their reactions that she involuntarily took a step back and was jostled sharply.
"Oi, watch it, you nit!"
She looked around and saw a stocky, bearded figure whom she immediately recognized as a dwarf. He had a dead goose draped over each shoulder, and the bird's long necks hung limply down his back. Grumbling about tourists, the dwarf marched away, the goose heads bobbing at his heels. Kate managed to say,
"That's a dwarf!"
"Course it's a dwarf,"
said Beetles, who was now cleaning his teeth with a match.
"What else would it be?"
"But,"
Kate stammered, "but..." And then she understood. Remembering the day that she and Emma had sat with Abraham beside his fire in the mansion in Cambridge Falls, and the old caretaker had told them how the magic world had once been a part of the normal world, but then the magic world had pulled away and hidden itself. According to Abraham, the division had happened on the last day of December in 1899. That meant...
"It's all still here," Kate said.
"Magic is still here."
"Not here."
Beetles jerked his head in the direction the dwarf had taken.
"The magic quarter's that way."
"Show me."
A minute later, Kate was standing at the end of a block of tenements. The muddy street was crammed with makeshift stalls. Vendors were hawking products. Shoppers were bundled up and hurrying against the cold. For being the magic quarter, Kate thought it all looked very normal. Then she noticed that one of the tenements, a reddish building with a wide front stoop, kept switching places with the building to its right, the result being that it was slowly making its way up the street. And she saw that another building shivered each time the wind blew, and that the windows of another, this made Kate very uneasy, kept winking at her. And besides the average-looking men and women going about their shopping, Kate saw dwarves moving through the crowd, smoking their long pipes and attracting no notice whatsoever. And there were other creatures, smaller than dwarves and beardless, who wore furry caps and stood arguing in tight groups, poking one another with their tiny fingers. Kate watched them in amazement, till a woman passed by carrying a basket and drew her attention. The woman was sweet-faced and grandmotherly, and Kate was about to smile at her when she saw that the woman's basket was alive and squirming with snakes. "Come on," said Jake and Beatles, and they each took an arm and led her forward. The first stall sold wigs of fairy hair in different colours, gold and silver, pure snowy white, a rather arresting pink. The next stall promised to remove curses. The one after that let you buy curses, boils, baldness, pursued by cats. There were three or four stalls occupied by fortune-tellers, one of whom was a girl of Kate's age who watched her closely as she went by. There was a stall that sold toads, tended by a man who looked like a toad himself and called out his wares in a deep, reverberating croak. There was a large tent where four shirtless and sweating dwarves hammered away at anvils with a rhythmic clinking and